So I was going to show my I don't have my my desktop on here. If you saw it, you would see I have a photo of Rick Savoir, however you pronounce his name, Rich Savoir from the Pirates. He sent us an email complaining about his photo because he looked like he was stoned in all of his players. He's a minor league pitching coach, and all of his players are giving a hard time about it. So he emailed us a photo, said, please update my photo. So that's the kind of stuff that we do day-to-day on Baseball Reference. So my talk today, this is a talk I gave at the Sabre Analytics Conference in March. So all the numbers are from 2017. I haven't updated it since then. If you follow me on Twitter, you know I just love when people make puns about war and wins above replacement. I mean, whenever you say war, what is it good for? I just chuckle inside because that's such a great pun. I've never heard that one before. So this talk is work that I've done. Hans von Schlieringer. When I did this in March, I didn't realize that Hans would be riding off to the Twins, so I don't know if this is an appropriate image for him leaving the company or not, but Hans has taken a job with the Twins and starts Monday, actually, with the Twins, so we'll miss him a lot and really appreciate all. He maintained Baseball Reference day-to-day for the last 3 years. Incidentally, we also have a job opening that you can find on our website. If you're a web developer, we'd love to talk to you. We also worked with some other experts, external experts in the field. Sean Smith here, known as Rally Monkey Online. So sometimes you'll see Baseball Reference War called R War for Rally Monkey. And then Tom Tango here in 2012. We reworked the system, did a big revamp of the system, and I must have sent him 24 emails on various and sundry different aspects of the system that he helped us out with. So basically, when we're talking about war, we're really trying to measure value. And so I've been online for 25, 30 years, and one of the big arguments that we always had is around the MVP awards. How do you measure the value of the players? Is it based on, can you have an MVP from a team that didn't win a lot of games? Can you have an MVP from a team that was a runaway winner? I mean, all that kind of stuff comes down to how you're measuring value. So we made our choices as to how to measure value. If you don't like our choices, I would suggest you to create your own system and come up with your own approaches for value. I'm going to lay out what we did and what our approach is. And there are many ways to do this, right? You could value wins and losses the most. Bill James and I got into a discussion this past fall because he felt that, you know, if your system does not mirror wins and losses for the team, then it has problems. And so I have a slightly different approach, which I'm going to lay out. You can look at runs scored, runs allowed, win probability added, which is completely context related. Component measures like WOBA and FIP. You can look at skills like launch angle, exit velocity, spin rate, things like that StatCast has. So you have to ask yourself these questions when you're creating these systems. Do you care more about, did it lead directly to winning the game? Is a home run in the bottom of the ninth in a 10-0 game a valuable event in and of itself, is kind of the question. You could ask yourself, how likely are they to do this again? Or you could ask yourself, what is the context neutral value of what they did? Okay, if you take out the context of the score, the teammates, you know, what's the value of what they did? So I consider this a continuum. You could go straight wins, losses. You could look more at skills, StatCast. I would say we're somewhere around about here is where I would put us. Win shares would be more over in this area over here. Fangraphs would probably be more over here. Whatever StatCast does for WAR, I'm guessing will probably be more over in this area. And so where you are on this continuum really guides the details in how you implement this, and you really have to consider that. So everything that we do when we're implementing our system is based upon this question. And so given the season's over, if I looking back, if I were the GM of a team with 4A players, you know, replacement level team, a team that needed players at every position, which player would add the most value to my team for that season going forward? Okay, so if I evaluate Mike Trout's 2017, how many wins would that add to my team at the start of the season? That's how I'm framing this question, and that's what our approach is. So if you don't like that, I can't really help you because that's the approach we're taking. And if you like a different system, that's fine with me. This is the system that we've implemented that I'm going to go through today. And there are lots of approaches. You could take P. Palmer's total player rating, WinShares, VORP, WARP, Fangraphs, WAR. There's an open framework for WAR. Ben Baumer, who used to work for the Mets, is now a math professor. I think it's on GitHub. I think it's written in R. So you could take that, make your own modifications to it, create your own WAR numbers. I think it even downloads all the data for you to calculate. I think it scrapes baseball reference. I'm not 100% sure, but I think the data might come from us. And even with all these approaches, though, there's often a consensus in how to value the players. So I looked at batters, Reggie Jackson. So this is from 54 to the present. So we have him as the 30th best player, probably, I think, because our defensive views of him are pretty negative. And then you have, you know, these other approaches. So he's somewhere between 15 and 30 among the all players in that, you know, what is that, 60 years now plus. Fergie Jenkins is even a tighter ranking. And if you know our two systems, BWAR and Fangraphs WAR, they're very different systems, very, very different systems. And so they still come to this consensus on Fergie Jenkins' value. So how do we do this? Kind of the basic steps. First off, I want to say, you know, as I go through this, one of the things I hope you'll get a sense of is that we try very hard to account for things, lots and lots of different factors. It's always a little frustrating to me sometimes because people email like, well, WAR's not any good because it doesn't consider X, Y, and Z. And, well, we do consider X, Y, and Z, and that factors into what we're doing. And so oftentimes, you know, we're really trying to account for a lot of the things that people, you know, we've listened to the criticism and tried to incorporate that into what we're doing. So the basic idea is we start looking at average. Average is well defined. We know how to compute averages very easily. We compare the player to average. We adjust for all the context that we have the player in here. So, you know, and we'll see those in a minute. How much would they help an average team, all right, an 81-win team? And then compare that to a replacement player. So basically WAR is always just wins above average plus a replacement level that's basically a playing time adjustment. That's really all it is. It's replacement level is just how much you played. The degree of which you get help by replacement levels is how much you played. And we have a lot of resources here. I do have to say my favorite thing about Sports Reference is that our URL shortener is GoodellMe. So we have all of these are just articles that we've written or sources. Some of Bill James's critiques we've added on our site. So this is all at baseballreference.com/about. You can take a look there. First step is to compare a player to average. And so basically, you know, remember, since we're comparing to average, if you take the difference of every player to average, it's going to add up to zero, right? So all of these components, if you add them across the league, add up to zero. Okay, so, you know, an average player will be zero value, will have zero as the number in these majors. Below average will be negative, above average positive. So for position players, batting is obviously the number one component. We use, I think, WOBA is probably the best batting measure out there at this point. It's basically a linear weight system that adjusts based on the run scoring environment. In a run scoring environment where there aren't a lot of base runners, home runs are less valuable because there are fewer base runners. On base, you can score fewer runs with those. But again, it's all relative to the league. We also filter out all the pitchers, so the pitchers don't affect the baseline. AL and L have the same baseline. We also include some play-by-play stuff that I think is important. So some hitters hit a lot of infield hits. Those are not as valuable as a hit to the outfield. So we have the play-by-play data, thanks to the heroes of RetroSheet, that we incorporate that information into our system when available. We also include things, we have different factors for strikeouts, non-strikeouts. This becomes an issue as you go further back, you know, because double play rates change over time, so you can't ground into a double play if you're striking out. So, you know, there are actually some cases where strikeouts are more valuable than not striking out. And so, you know, we take all these things into account. We also have a sacrifice bunt intentional walk adjustment that I'm not going to go into at this point. So on the left here, we have the all-time leaders and all-time trailers at the bottom, the worst hitters in Major League history, the best hitters in Major League history. And then last year, we have the values here. My favorite Larry Boa stat, Larry Boa hit 260, 300, 320 for his career was a slash line. So if Larry Boa came out of retirement, he would have to hit 186 consecutive home runs to get a 400 career slugging percentage. On the base running side, we take into account a lot of things. So obviously, caught stealing, stolen bases are the main thing. Some years we don't know caught stealing, so we did a lot of study into how to handle those situations. The other thing we do very carefully is we track base advancement. So how many times you go from first to third on a single? How many times you go from first to second? How many times you're thrown out on a ball to the outfield? How many times you go from first to home on a double, et cetera, et cetera? How many times you take a base on a wild pitch or a pass ball? You score on ground outs? All those things go into this base running adjustment. We even, in the case of where we know where the ball was hit, we have a different factor for when the single was to right field than when the single was to left field. Because, you know, if you're more likely to go to third on a single to right field than you are on a single to left field. So all those things go into this base running number. And obviously we know the average weights. We compare the player to the average weights. We know how much a base is worth, how much an out is worth, and we use those to estimate runs. One other quick thing. On double plays, we assume that you're going to hit into a certain number of double plays given the situations you're in. So Ryan Howard doesn't get penalized for coming up to bat in a lot of double play situations because Chase Utley and Jason Worth and Shane Victorino get on base a lot. But he would get penalized if he grounds into double plays on a higher than average level in those situations. Okay, so that's kind of a subtle thing. But you can ground into a double plays and not get penalized by our system because it's not your fault your teammates are on base in those situations. Okay, but if you are good at avoiding double plays, you get a little bit of a bonus. It's not a huge factor, but it does count at times. So these are the base runners. So again, obviously the best base stealers of all time are here at the top, Reigns, Wilson, Henderson, Paul Konerko. These are all the slowest players in Major League history. I don't think this surprises anybody. So Konerko did not steal bases, but he has a huge negative value because he never took the extra base. So I looked this up. Konerko went from first to third on a single only 15% of the time. Okay, 15% of the time he went from first to third on a single. Tim Raines went 36% of the time from first to third on a single. And now they in their careers, long careers, they had over 500 opportunities to go first to third on a single. So Raines added over 100 bases over the course of his career in these situations. Okay, so that adds up. That's significant. That's, you know, 50, 60 runs that Raines added just going first to third more than Konerko did. So we count for all those. Fielding, obviously, is probably the most controversial aspect of this. We try to use the best numbers available at the time, so we're currently using Baseball Info Solutions numbers. Their defensive runs saved. Occasionally, they go back and readjust things. You know, Chris didn't go into the details yesterday of these, but they're paying people to watch every single game, every single play, with a stopwatch to track the hang time of every ball, the location of where every ball is hit. So for every play in every major league game for the last 15 years, they know the location, the hang time, and whether it was caught for every ball in major league in those games. Okay, so they then compare the fielders to average. They have some other things for arm ratings and things like that. You can see how many times we know how many times the base runners went first to third. We know how many times they went first to third on each outfielder as well, and we account for that. And so a lot of these things go into these ratings, and I feel pretty comfortable that they have significant statistical value. For those seasons we don't have that, we then go back to Sean Smith's total zone system, which uses battered ball location when available, battered ball type when available, and then before that you're using more regression-based methods, similar to what Michael Humphreys had in the Fielding Bible. I'm sorry, what was Michael Humphreys' book?
Wizardry.
We don't include pitcher defense because that goes into their pitching war instead of their batting war. There's some other things we could do. I don't even care that much if I get the StatCast data to update war. What I would like to do is I'd like to say, well, based on the systems we have and based on what StatCast tells us, which are the best systems cross-validating with the StatCast data. So even if we got like two-year-old StatCast data and could compare it to like Total Zone or DRS, that to me that would have significant value. So here are the best fielders of all time by our measures, Brooks Robinson, Belanger. You know, these are fairly conventional names. You'll see a trend here starting in the worst fielders of all time. Same thing, you know, for last season. So 30 runs is a big fielding effect. If you want to make the argument we should regress these numbers a little bit due to uncertainty, I am somewhat sympathetic to that argument, but haven't really, you know, I'm not quite sure how you would go about doing that yet, or if it's necessary. But obviously fielding is where the biggest controversy is. I would point out batters change from year to year. Guys can have good batting seasons and bad batting seasons. Guys can have good fielding seasons and bad fielding seasons. It's not, you know, there's no reason why batting and fielding should be different in consistency, in my opinion, at least. We also have a position adjustment. Catchers, I don't think I'm breaking any news here when I say catchers hit worse than first basemen on a major league level. It's easier to find a first baseman who can hit than a catcher who can hit. So we have, these are based on 2008 estimates from Sean Smith. This is probably an area where we need to do a little work and maybe make these update a little more regularly than they have been. But these are the adjustments. And this is basically just, you play 150 games, you get plus 9 runs if you're a catcher, you get minus 15 if you're a DH. Okay. Now I know there is a DH penalty. There's been some argument that maybe DHs shouldn't get this big of a penalty. Again, that's something that probably should be studied a little bit more. If you add all these up, though, you're going to get zero across the playing time. So the position adjustment is zero in total. For pitchers on defense, on their position adjustment, pitchers are kind of off in their own bucket, and their total runs contributed to the whole system is zero. So basically we just offset whatever, these are negative values, so whatever these negatives are, we offset it by a positive value for the position there. So, you know, you can add, a good hitting pitcher can add some significant value to, above a bad hitting pitcher over time. Jeff Zimmerman at FanGraphs, did some really nice work on these position adjustments, which we would like to incorporate at some point. So again, this is just guys who played a lot of shortstop versus guys who played a lot of DH in first base. This has no quality aspect to it. This is purely playing time at these positions. That's all this is, playing time at these positions. Wins above average. So we've got all these components. We're going to plug them in to our system to get wins above average for a player. And it's fairly straightforward. Bonds in 93, played 159 games. He was plus 68.3 on offense, runs. So this is all this is in runs. Plus 3 on defense, so he's a better than average fielder. So if we look at what the average team would score in the Giants, given the Giants Park context, I think I didn't put it up here, but I think the average team would have scored like 4.57 runs, somewhere in there. So if you add Barry Bonds to that average team, their scoring average goes up to 4.93 runs. So he adds about a half run a game to their offense. He subtracts a small amount on defense. Okay, so you put Barry Bonds on an average team, they're going to have about a half run advantage per game, okay, in that season. So runs scored, runs allowed. How do we convert that to wins? We use the Pythagorean theorem, all right? Bill James introduced. We're going to use a little bit better one, the Pythagorean PAT, which has a variable exponent based on the run scoring environment because it fits a little better to the run scoring. So we use that, plug that into that equation. We get a 549 win-loss percentage for Bonds' team with average players. And 549 minus 500 times 159 is 7.8 wins. Okay, and that's it. That's how we get wins above average for them. So for pitchers, similar idea. There's a little more context that we consider on the pitching side. We use run average per nine. We start with that instead of ERA. If you think about it, the ERA is a defense-adjusted pitching number, but it's adjusted by fielding percentage. Okay, so it's a fielding percentage adjusted pitching number. Okay, so fielding percentage is not the best defensive metric, so we can adjust by a different defensive metric and get a better value than we would if we're using earned run average. So we use run average as our baseline. And then the pitchers, we can move them to a different park context, a different opponent quality context, in a defensive support context. Okay, so these three factors: defense, park, opponent. Okay, an opponent, obviously, for opponents, we're looking at them in a park neutral situation, right? So the Padres have a bad offense. They also play in a very good pitcher's park, so you have to kind of divorce those two things. There are good offenses that play in pitcher's parks. There are bad offenses that play in hitter's parks, okay? So you have to take that context into account. And this really matters because pitchers only pitch, you know, starting pitchers pitch 30 to 35 games. As I'll show in a second here, one pitcher on the staff is going to face a much different context than another pitcher on the staff. So first thing we do is we're taking a league average pitcher, so the league average run average per nine, and we're adjusting it into that pitcher's context. So we say a league average pitcher, if they had Clayton Kershaw's opponent, defense, and parks, what would they have done? So we're going to make that adjustment. We also account for quality opponent first, and these are the average runs per game scored by that opponent, adjusted for park. And we also account for DH. Obviously, if you're an NL pitcher, you have an easier go. We account for interleague DH games as well. So if you're an AL pitcher who pitches a lot of NL games, we account for that. So these are two pitchers last year, Rich Hill and Ryu, both pitched for the Dodgers. I took out their common opponents. So these are their uncommon opponents. So Rich Hill had three games against the Padres, two games against the Diamondbacks and Cardinals. Ryu had three games against the Rockies, Nationals, Cubs. So he had a harder set of opponents than Hill did. So Hill had an easier context than Ryu just by quality of opponent. We also customized by park factor. If I'm out when my team goes to Coors, I've avoided playing a really hard pitcher's park, a really hard park for pitchers. That context needs to be adjusted for me. And we also, it's weighted by the batters faced in each park. So if you go three innings in one park and nine innings in another park, we account for that. Ryu, again, had a harder context, about a league average, while Hill pitched more pitcher's parks. Same team, different context because they don't play in the same game, basically. They're both starters. Quality of defense. So like I said, ERA is adjusted for defense, but as for fielding percentage, we're going to adjust using our DRS numbers. Okay, so we know how many balls in play each pitcher allowed. We know the runs saved or cost by the players behind them. And so we proportionally assign those runs to the pitchers based on how many balls in play, what percentage of the balls in play they allowed for the team. And now this is probably a little bit of a gap because some pitcher, a slow working pitcher might have worse defense behind him than a good working pitcher. Maybe a shortstop was out for the half season that you were on the team. We don't account on a game by game basis by who was in the field behind you. It's really just adjusted for the full season. So, the effects are, they can be somewhat large. So, for example, Rick Porcello allows a lot of balls in play. Boston's defense was phenomenal last year. So we figure that if he had a league average defense behind him, he would have allowed 10 more runs for the season than what he did. Okay, so we're adjusting for that. Jacob DeGrom, Mets had a terrible defense behind him. He should have had 7.5 fewer runs for the season. These are season totals, 7.5 fewer runs up for the season. So we add this all together, and what we find are there are some significant effects here. Clayton Kershaw had the easiest context of any pitcher last year in the major leagues. A league average pitcher would have had allowed a 4.06 ERA, a 4.06 RA in his situation. All right, you see all the Dodgers here. You don't have to face the Dodgers offense. You are in a pitcher's park. Some of the NL West teams aren't good offensive teams. So all that contributes to this. Detroit is terrible defense. Faced a lot of good offenses, so their pitchers, Matt Boyd, the average pitcher, just an average pitcher, would have expected to have a 5.7 run average in his context. Okay, so that's over a run and a half difference between the worst and the best context in the league. So that's what the average pitcher would do. So we adjust, based on that run average, we get the difference between what the pitcher actually allowed and what their run average was. Just to go back to this for a second. So Boyd had a 5.6 ERA for the season, so an 87 ERA plus, which is below average. But for all things considered, we considered him to be a league average pitcher in WAR. All right, even though he had a 5.6 ERA, he was a league average pitcher in WAR for the season. So we add all this up. You know, we have the average value for the pitchers, for what an average pitcher would do. We have what that pitcher did. We convert it into the win-loss percentage, same way with the batters, and we multiply it by the number of games pitched. We also do a role adjustment for relievers to handle leverage situations. So, you know, Billy Wagner, Mariano Rivera, Trevor Hoffman, they're coming in high leverage situations, so that adds a little bit of value to the team. I mean, to some degree we do this because otherwise the relievers are really, really lowly valued in WAR, and I think that probably undersells it if you look at salaries and things like that. So they get a small bonus, but even with this, like last year, anybody have a guess as to the best relief pitcher by WAR? Played for the Diamondbacks. Archie Bradley was the best, I heard somebody say it. Archie Bradley was the best reliever last year, but he finished 24th in pitcher WAR. Okay, and I think that's usually the case year over year, that the best reliever is going to be somewhere in the 20s or 30s in terms of overall WAR. You know, Jason Vargas was slightly more valuable than Archie Bradley was to his team, even though Bradley was the best reliever in the majors last year. So we've got everybody compared to average. Everybody knows what average is. We're all happy. You know, I think we can agree on how to compute an average. So where we get into trouble and where I think we start to lose people a little bit is with the replacement level idea. So why use a replacement level? And the reason is because being average has value. If I say a person is 0 wins above average, that player is not making the league minimum. Right? If you sign a major league player to a free agent contract and they're an average player, they're going to get $8, $9, $10 million a year. Right? They're not, an average major league player is not getting the league minimum. Right? They have value. So this is kind of an example that I give here. Alfonso Soriano and Troy Neal both had about the same wins above average. All right, but one of them made $159 million in his career, and the other one made $350,000. Okay? And the difference is games played. Soriano played 2,000 games of league average baseball, obviously in spectacularly dramatic fashion, but he was league average value-wise. And Troy Neal only played 230 games of league average baseball. Okay, so Soriano had more value in his career. I feel comfortable saying that. And so, you know, so we want to give credit to that. And so Soriano ends up with 27.4 WAR, while Neal only has 3.7 WAR. And so WAR is, the replacement level adjustment is purely a playing time adjustment. That's all it's based on. It's how much did you play, how good was the league, and that's all the adjustment is. So if you're looking at MVP for a single season, you're looking at full-time players, right? Miguel Cabrera versus Mike Trout. They both played full-time for the season. They're both going to have the exact same replacement level adjustment. Okay, so you could look at wins above average in that situation and get the exact same ordering of players. Now, last year, Trout missed some games, so that has some value. So he might have, that adjustment, if the playing time is unequal, it's going to be slight. But it's really just based on playing time. So guys, this rewards guys with long careers who had at least average value in that time. So, you know, it helps Omar Vizquel's somewhat shaky Hall of Fame case, you know, more than it would if we just looked at wins above average. So replacement level, where we try to set that is the difference between a league average player and a freely available player. Okay, so freely available players, waiver players, minor league free agents, non-roster invitees. And so, you know, we kind of, in setting this, you can look at how do these players produce in general over the season. You know, if you look at the guys who aren't on the opening day roster, how do they produce during the season? And so we ended up setting the value somewhere around a 48-win team. And I feel comfortable saying that if you gave a decent GM the opportunity to pick any of these, you know, freely available talent starting in October, you could probably get somewhere around a 48-win team. Okay, the worst teams in history only rarely reach this level. So, in Fangraphs, we had the Sabre Analytics Convention maybe 6 years ago, we agreed to set the same value. So the total amount of WAR available in the league, if you add up all the WAR for all the players, it comes out to 1,000 WAR. And that's true on Fangraphs and it's true on us, so our scales are the same. We have the same scale value. The other thing we do is we adjust by league. So the AL has been typically a more difficult league. You can see that in interleague results. You can see that when players get traded from one league to the other. Players leaving the AL tend to do better in the NL. And so, again, this is something where there's ongoing study, and you know, we want to make sure that we're on top of any trends, things are changing, or anything like that. But you know, you heard Neil Huntington basically say that last night as well, right? He said, "Well, if we were in the AL, we wouldn't even be in the playoff race, but in the NL, you know, we have a shot." So we have this replacement level, and basically we're just looking at the playing time. So if you have a replacement level player who plays 160 games, how far worse than average is he going to be? And so it's usually about 2 wins a season. Okay, so on average, comes in between either 18 or 22 runs, depending on where you set the replacement level for the leagues. And so it adds about 2 wins for the season, generally, compared to an average player. So WAR is basically just that wins above average number that I went through before, plus this replacement adjustment overall. So we made some recent tweaks this past year. Sports Info Solutions. I didn't mention this earlier, but I compare WAR. So people don't like WAR for a lot of reasons, but one of them is I can't compute it. And so I compare WAR to gross domestic product in that sense. You know, you're trying to measure the value of an economy. It's going to be a little bit messy. The UN has a document with the guidelines for computing GDP. It's 100 pages long. You may not have all the data available to you to compute it, but you have there are experts who have studied the issue for a long time and you know work to implement it. And there are different frameworks for GDP. Different people include different things in their numbers. So, and sometimes it gets restated after the fact because new data becomes available. Maybe the unemployment number gets changed or something like that. So we, you know, WAR has similar issues where it's a complicated framework. The data can be hard to get at some point. You have to spend a lot of work setting up your data set. And sometimes the numbers get restated. So, for example, our park factors are N-1, N, and N+1. So at the end of the 2018 season, the 2017 park factors are going to change, which will in turn change the WAR numbers for 2017. So you have to be comfortable with a little bit of squishiness in your numbers there. I'm comfortable with that. And so, you know, these numbers, as more information comes available, we adjust them. We made an Ohtani adjustment this year. Of course, he went and got injured and, you know, kind of made it pointless. But basically, we were overvaluing players who played in the field, like Red Ruffing and George Yule and Red Lucas from the 30s and 40s, because we were giving them too much credit for being a pitcher in those position player settings. Because they played a lot of outfield. But again, these weren't big changes. Over a course of her career, the biggest change was, I think CeCe Sabathia had like a 2 WAR out of 50. He has a 50 career WAR. I think his went down maybe 2 WAR for the season. Which if you're Jay Jaffe and writing a book based on our WAR numbers, I assume is pretty frustrating. But we have a website so we can make those changes relatively easy. So for future study, want to work to adjust the replacement level on an ongoing basis, continue to study that, the position run values. We've had some thoughts on how you could put error bars. To be honest, personally, when I look at 2 WAR numbers, if they're less than 1 win apart, I really don't consider them to be that different statistically. So if one guy is 6.5 and another guy is 5.8, I would say vote for either for MVP, you know, based on other considerations, do more study. Always evaluating with the defensive metrics, can we do better park factors? Should position players have strength of opponent? So for a long time, Albert Pujols faced like the easiest basket of pitchers in the National League. He had the Cardinals opponents, the NL Central had terrible pitchers when Pujols was there. So he probably had an easier context than some other players did, which might have boosted his apparent value more than it was. Not huge, but it probably had some impact. And obviously, RetroSheet is adding play-by-play every year, and we incorporate that. So thanks to the Sports Reference crew. We're 10 strong in Philadelphia. I'm on Twitter at Sean_Foreman. And again, the tough slide talks are available if you want to take a look at them later. So thank you. I don't know, we have time for questions? Yeah. Questions? All right.
I'm doing one.
Keep it to one.
Okay.
One.
By definition, half of all replacement level players are below replacement level. which is meaningless when you look at the career of, you know, a guy who made, but it really messes up the fringe players. So WAR is meaningless for them. So think about that. It should be a standard deviation. You should take the replacement level player pool, go 1 or 1.5 standard deviations below that. That's the actual replacement level. Think about it.
All right, I'll think about it.
You know, I listen to a lot of this stuff, and I guess my question, if you want to call it a question, is can you off the top of your head name maybe three ball players that are really pretty darn good that we don't think of are good, and maybe three ball players that we thought of as very, very good who aren't really, and names like Rod Carew kind of come to mind. If you look at this, I have a funny feeling Rod Carew. He's not as good as we were led to believe when
we
started his career.
Oh, yeah, I mean.
You know, so my question to you is, can you just off the top of your head fire up three names, these three guys?
Well, I mean, Curt Schilling, like, is a dead-to-rights Hall of Famer by this measure. Mike Messina is easy Hall of Famer by this measure. The relievers are wildly overrated. You know, I mean, by WAR, Trevor Hoffman, Goose Gossage, Bruce Sutter, none of those would be anywhere near the Hall of Fame. WAR generally is like a 60 WAR is kind of the cutoff. Lou Whitaker is wildly underrated in our opinion. Trammell was underrated. Bobby Grich. Basically, what I think this method does a nice job is that players who are good at everything are generally undervalued compared to players who are great at one particular thing. I mean, Tony Gwynn was a great player, but he was overrated, for what he actually contributed to winning on the field. He was a good base runner, a good fielder, but I mean, his value, perceived value, was less than I think what the league was. Guys like Bobby Grich, Kenny Lofton was criminally underrated. I mean, he was great at everything, was good at everything for a very long time. Guys who are good at all the facets of the game. Chase Utley, being in Philly, is a dead-to-rights Hall of Famer in my book. And best fielder at second base, best base runner at second base, best batter at second base for about a 10-year period. But he's probably not going to get into the Hall of Fame. Didn't get MVP votes. He should have won one or two. He probably should have won the MVPs that Ryan Howard and Jimmy Rollins won, to be honest with you, Dan.
John, I'm just curious for the other sites, how much thought has gone into, is it close to this for like football values, hockey values, basketball
so,
values, how does that relate to
on the NBA side, yes, I would say so. On the football side, I call these Uber stats. Our Uber stat on football is called approximate value, which should give you some read on how we view that. It's very hard to, so basically what happened on football, this. I like this story, so I'll just share. But on the football side, what we did, Doug Drennan, who created the football site, is a math professor at Sewanee University of the South. He basically picked the 200 greatest NFL players of all time and sent out a poll and say, do you think player A or player B is better? And then, based on that ranking system, he created a metric that matched that ranking system based on that. And so that's why we call it approximate value. Because when you're comparing a guard to a defensive lineman, we don't have the stats really to have any. So we're using Pro Bowls and All Pros and stuff like that. As an interesting aside, Chris was talking about momentum in MVP and Gold Glove voting for fielders. If you look at offensive and defensive linemen, it's the exact same thing. The same offensive lineman gets voted into the Pro Bowl for like five straight years, and then people realize, well, he's not really actually that good anymore, and then he stops getting voted into the Pro Bowl. Doesn't happen with quarterbacks and running backs because they have stats that you can actually look at. Right? Doesn't happen with MVP because you have stats that you can actually look at.
Under the umbrella of players who do a lot of things well get undervalued, something that organizations value but perhaps doesn't shine through as a reference is positional versatility. Is there any talk about promoting someone's defensive, positional adjustment based on his versatility?
Right. I mean, there certainly would be some value to not having to use an extra roster spot for a third baseman because your middle infielder can play. And, I mean, we our position adjustment is based on playing time at each position, so we give them value for that. We don't give them any boost on being able to play multiple positions. My academic background is optimization, so I've often thought about this in terms of a knapsack problem where you have to fit 25 players into a roster and you have to satisfy each of these things. So having some positional flexibility would probably have some value to the team, but we haven't tried quantifying that. Yeah.
One question, because we do have to clear for everybody.
All right. You had a comment already. You asked something today, so Joe, I'll let you. Sorry.
All right. So the defensive spectrum, I guess, right, your positional adjustment, that has shifted over time. It shifts minorly every once in a while. You know, the big one with second base and third base.
Right.
How often is that dynamic every year?
So Sean Smith had updates over the course of history. So we actually list the numbers on the, if you go to that set of references that I had earlier, we list them on there. But so you can actually find them on this page here, somewhere on the position player, probably WAR, I think it's under position players WAR. We have that listed. We have not changed it since 2008, which probably should. There's probably been some adjustment. I think if you look at it, I consider the defensive spectrum to be a Y. You have shortstop, second base, third base. Like everybody collects into first base, then you have catchers, and then you have out center field, right field, left field, and they all collect at first base at the end of the defensive Y is what I consider it. But yeah, we need to go back and add that at some point. There are a couple people I bug, like, you should come work for us and do that, but they always push me off. So. All right, and I think that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you.